Hello, everyone. Thank you again for joining us and listening to today's podcast. I'm here with Beate, and we are excited about today's topic. This is our third episode, and we thought about one of the very important topics that we actually always discuss when we have our calls, right?
Yes, it's a continuous conversation that we have,
yeah,
almost every week.
Exactly. And that's how do you keep family and friends close after a brain injury? And it might seem a little bit childish, I guess. Not, I don't even know, like easy to talk about it, but it's actually not. It's quite a topic.
Yes, it seems almost like a topic not worthwhile discussing, something that kind of just happens naturally in life because all of us are social beings. So why would things change so much? And it does change. That's the whole point.
Exactly. It does change. And I think everyone who has a brain injury probably can relate to it to some extent. I actually, and maybe also you, didn't even have a clue when I had my brain injury that this will happen, that so much is going to change in terms of friendships and in terms of who is close from my family and who understands it and who not.
Yeah, so true. Yeah, I mean, we had no idea, like with so many other things. And yeah, it's like nothing or no one really preps you for it, right? You just kind of have to figure it out like along the road. And I'm so thankful that I had you by my side. But yes, it is an extremely strange thing
journey
to manage.
Yeah.
Yes, journey to manage after a brain injury.
And I wish there was like a manual, you know, that all these products today have manuals, but obviously life doesn't have a manual. But I was just so clueless about, you know, that friends that I've had for maybe 10, 15 years already are going to actually not be my friends anymore and things like that. And I just want us to talk about what actually happens after a brain injury that makes or breaks a relationship. Because I think there are clearly specific things that some people get, some others maybe try to get for a while, and then they think we're too busy getting the same treatment from this person. And I heard so many times people saying, aren't you back to 100%? You know, almost like they were losing their patience.
Yeah, so true. Yeah. Do you want to kick us off with an example? Because I have something that I'm already thinking of.
Yes. Well, I want to have the example of my husband, because he's like the only person in my life that I feel like doesn't have a brain injury, but still is the closest to understanding as possible. That's obviously a positive example, because I feel that in my life there are very few positive examples of people who understand and stayed. Like, I have a lot of examples of people who were my friends for a long time before, were feeling very sorry for what happened to me, and a few months after, they were impatient about, when am I going to be back to normal? Why are things not the same? And then, you know, we did or so completely lost their interest in the friendship with a, you know, brain injured person,
because you think it's because you couldn't be the same friend to them?
I think so. I think people are used to the specific traits of a person, like of a friend, and if those change, then the everything, the relationship changes.
Yes.
So I think I changed as a person, my abilities changed, what I can do changed. And when all those things were like shown to them, I think that's what happened. They were like, we're not up for this. Like, this is not the type of relation or friendship we want. But luckily, my husband is like not in that category. So he's like the opposite. He was he was not expecting anything. He was not making expectations of, and I think for you, it's probably the same with your husband. And there wasn't really like an expectation of, oh, maybe in a month, you're going to be fine. Or maybe in 2 months and everything is going to be back. Like the Beate and Alexandra from before are back. So those expectations were not there. And I'm very grateful because I feel like I can go to someone and, you know, go through what my struggles are. I mean, someone that doesn't have a brain injury, you know.
I'm trying to think, like, why is it that, you know, the two of them are so, I almost want to say, understanding towards us? Is it just because we, you know, very much in love? Or is it that they, you know, kind of, you know, I almost want to say, like, turn a blind eye towards it and they still see us for the human beings that we are? Or is it because I do feel from Michal's side, he kind of had a better understanding than most people of what to expect after, you know, I went through the injury, because he reads a lot. He comes from a medical family.
Yeah.
And I think he did a lot of reading even while I was still very much about what was happening in the first, you know, say 6 months, where I didn't really have a grip on myself even. Yeah. And an understanding of what was happening. He was doing a lot of reading, and I mean, obviously he chose to love me. You know, we made our vows, you know, for better and for worse and through sickness and health. But this is definitely something, I mean, you make vows or you think you're a friend with someone or in a relationship with someone, but this is definitely a very big curveball that life can throw at you. And some people just can't.
Yeah.
Like some friendships can't survive. Yeah, but sorry, I feel like I've interrupted you. Please continue.
No, I mean, you were asking what makes them understand. And I think, like, Michal and Nick, they are, like, different. But, like, Michal is a lot into reading. And it's great that he took his, you know, time to understand what was happening from, like, a kind of medical point. And Nick is not really like that, but he's has that part that is very empathetic. Is that the word?
Yes, empathetic. Yes, it is.
So he's like always trying to empathize with someone, no matter what. And I think also being there 24/7 with me, he was seeing, you know, the struggles. He was also seeing the days when I had better days, but he was always there when I had like a pain or headaches crying or panic attacks or things like that. So he knew that there's so much more than people can see in, you know, a 10-minute conversation or 1 hour lunch, or I don't know.
Yes.
So then I think in that sense it's a bit easier for them as husbands that are with us, you know, 24/7 almost, to understand what is actually going on than for, you know, a friend that maybe we speak to 10 minutes or 15 minutes a day or an hour at most.
Yeah, an hour a week or however long you would have seen them.
Exactly.
Yeah, because obviously they love us and they've lived with us and they've seen us even before the injuries, like when we, you know, happy and when we sad and when we're anxious. So they kind of already know how to read our emotions, I almost want to say, right? They kind of have an understanding for who we are. So it could have meant that they already knew some of our cues.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so. And I think it's also related to, you know, in therapy, they always told me that brain injury is a grief process. So, you know, when you just had the brain injury, and I did go, and we were probably also, I mean, for sure, went through denial, like, oh yeah, this is in the past, it's happened, I'm fine, I'm just going to go continue my life. And you try to deny that it's something going on.
Yes, I think for me, that was almost, I wanted to handle the denial part thereof or it's easy to say in retrospect, but within a month.
Yeah.
I thought 1 month, you know, like this, yeah, it's kind of something that happened, like whatever. It's like the biggest part is over because I'm out of hospital, you know. I thought, okay, I just have to hang on because things might feel a little bit weird still, but things are going to go back to normal, you know, very quickly. It's almost like when you're at the end of being, you know, sick, where you have the flu and your throat is still like a little bit itchy, but it's not really like sore and you're not coughing anymore. I kind of thought like, oh, I'm just feeling a little bit weird still.
Yeah,
but
me too.
The blindness will disappear and like, look, I'm walking again. Like, you know, I'm fine. Like I'm going to be okay. And my never die spirit definitely kicked in very hard of survival and thinking, don't worry, I've got this. Like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I had the exact same. And especially at the period when I was in hospital, I remember I was like in my head very upset that I was there because I felt like I can't sleep here. There's too much light. Like I personally can never sleep unless it's pitch dark, like very black in the room. Don't see nothing. So in hospital, it was almost like daylight in the night. So I could not close an eye, even if I had like... how are they called? Eye patches? Eye mask? Sleeping, yes. You know? Sleeping mask. I still could not sleep because of all the noises of those machines and whatever. So I was like, this is the worst part. It's as soon as I get home to my bed and I get quiet and everything is going to be fine. I'm going to be back to just how I am.
But even you had two hospital visits. So you probably had that kind of that experience after both of them. Or not?
No, because the first one I cannot remember except 2 days, like the first time. Mm. So that one is like a bit of a blur. I don't really remember except the last.
What did you feel after, from what you now can remember, right? Like after the days that have now been lost in the first time you went to the hospital, did you think like, oh, this is not a big deal? Or the fact that your surgery was kind of, you know, still scheduled, or like how did things play out?
Well, I was scared because like a brain surgery was following, and I never was in a hospital before that, like for nothing. And my biggest fear ever before was that I would have an appendix surgery, which is like the easiest.
Yes.
And I was terrified about it, like to a high level, like very terrified. So you can imagine that having a brain surgery then is like a whole different other level. So I was home like crying almost every night, and my mom was also visiting, and she was like, don't cry because maybe you're gonna have another, because they told us that if you're like stressing because you had like a brain bleed and it was not fixed, it's the chance of re-bleed, it's very high. So I was trying not to cry, but it was so hard because I thought I can't go through this surgery. It's so difficult. But, you know, in that time, I felt like everyone was around me. Everyone was sympathetic, and, you know, everyone was trying to say how sorry they are that I have to go through this surgery that was coming up.
Was that mostly friends? Was it family?
Everyone, family, friends, colleagues. It was really a big support in that month. I think it was 3 weeks between. So I was really, in a way, encouraged with that support. Like, oh, look, it's not so bad. Everybody's thinking about me. I must be just strong because it's going to go fast. And then I'm going to go back. And it's going to be another just life, great life. And... then after the surgery, it was for like the first week worse because I had like a swollen face, like really swollen. I have to show you some photos, but I'm embarrassed because they are very embarrassing. It's just horrible. Like,
yeah. No.
And it was just because of the, they gave me this obviously sleeping to what is it called?
Sleeping pills? Sleeping medicine?
No, when anesthetic.
Oh, yes.
And I was in surgery for almost 9 hours. So they had to put quite some anesthetic. And I think that had an impact because I had a lot of hallucinations after.
Really?
Like really vivid things. Yeah. So, you know, those didn't help. And in my recovery, because then I had to go for like some PTSD treatment. But in that...
How long after the surgery was that? The therapy, right? The PTSD therapy.
Well, quite some time because they didn't have space for me. So they only got me there in June. And I had the surgery in April. So in between, I was having like nightmares and seeing these things. And it was very... I even didn't want to talk about it because I saw them so real. Like they happened, and I was scared to say it with out loud because it sounded crazy. So I was saying to Nick only like a few months after. It was a bit, it was tough, but I still thought like, you know, I'm going to be fine and stuff is going to work out the way I want. And only like 6 to 7 months after did it start to get harder on an like emotional level, and also starting to see people don't understand it anymore.
Say that again. How many months?
Maybe like half a year after.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I can relate to that.
I think like that was the threshold when probably people's because I think people also have to go with you through those stages. I mean, probably Nick did go with me through like the denial stage. He also in the beginning was like, it's going to be fine. I was like, yeah, it's going to be fine. Then, you know, the next stage, which is like anger. And I was like, why me? This is horrible. I cannot live like this. And, you know, I'm grateful that he went through all these stages and is still here. Whereas I think the most of people start with you on a stage and then quickly like fall off and you know, they don't want to stay on for the rest. And also you see that I at least see this even in friends that stayed or new people that I meet, because now I'm like, I'm kind of at the acceptance part more and more. So I already tell from the beginning, like if I have a new friend or whatever, look, if we are to meet, I'm going to meet you for an hour. It's going to be great, but after I have to go. Or, you know, I tell them already. Like, this is
that
it.
Is actually one of my questions for today is, or things that I thought we might, you know, pick up on, is meeting new friends after the injury and how long it takes for you or myself to kind of tell them what happened. And I think for many people, and even some friends of mine or people that I know say like, oh no, you don't have to tell everyone about your injury, right? You can, you know, it's not something that you have to kind of disclose.
It's personal,
you
can
just, it's personal. It's just, you know, it's just something that happened in the past. And I think that to me again shows that they have no understanding that it's not in the past. It's something that I live with every single day.
Exactly.
And sure, I'm not going to tell, you know, the person behind the counter in the hardware store, you know, please don't bang on the counter that loudly, sir, because I can't hear you. I'm not going to do that. If you want to be part of my life, if you want to be my friend, I'm definitely going to have to tell you at some point, because it's very much part of my everyday life. And if we want to be friends, you'll have to, unfortunately, accept and accommodate me, because my needs will definitely be different to other people's needs.
Exactly. So, I think it's the same for me too. And maybe for others in this situation, just as much. And it's hard. I think the hardest part is to educate people that are not involved directly. Like I feel that friends and maybe some relatives, they're not involved directly in, like I have a cousin, and you know, a while ago when I was home, he was asking me, why don't I take a driving lesson course? So So, but it's,
yeah, okay, but you first you have to give the listeners some
background that background, they want to hear. Also, it depends on the person because, for example, this person, this cousin, he knows that I had you know, a stroke and that I had the brain surgery, but he doesn't understand what that means today. So he was going on about how I should do this driver license class and that it will help me in the future. So I didn't, like, I didn't start a conversation about how I can't concentrate. I can't, I don't have divided attention. So I can't really do a driver's class.
But just to give the listeners context as well. So Alexandra doesn't have a driver's license. So she's not had one prior to the injury. She never needed one. And it was actually something that you were thinking of starting, or actually I think you started, right? With lessons.
Just before.
Yes, like a few months prior to the injury, because you thought that maybe for work it'll be a good idea to get a car and you might be able to get around the city and different cities easier instead of using the public transport. So Alexandra was thinking about it, and then obviously after the injury, you feel like...
There's no way. I feel like... I even got on the bike, but that was a year ago, and I was completely lost. I mean, I could still bike, but because of not having any divided attention, I could not bike because I could not bike and at the same time look to understand what's going on at the left and the right and the front, and it was just very stressful. So after that, I was like, nah, I'm just gonna sell my bike and no. It's not.
But Alexandra, I mean, oh my goodness, it's just so funny because, I mean, of course, you lived in countries where you didn't need a license, so that therefore you didn't, you know, you've never needed one, so why would you get one, right? But like here, you can't go anywhere if you don't have a license. So that was one of my key things that I worked at so hard in to kind of get back, because I lost so many things with freedom and so on. And it's funny how I laughed so loudly because I'm so happy you also say that, like, no, like, hell no, it's definitely not going to be possible for me to get a license. And sometimes I still feel that way. Like, yes, I went through the freaking driving school, and disability driving school was awful because it made me so, you know, extremely aware of all my shortcomings. But I still experience it today. Like, every single day I get in a car, I still feel that way. And it's funny how people think, like, oh, Beata got her license again at the end of 2018. You know, she must be fine. Like, she's like, oh no, she's driving, she's good. The struggle is so freaking real. It's
I think, and, so that it is it's a lot of things that are missing now from us, like the things with attention, divided attention, some of the other things that you have to focus a lot. And I mean, for you, maybe it's, it is, I mean, not maybe, but it is an advantage that you had a license before. So at least, you know, you knew the rules from before. You didn't have to learn everything, but it's still so difficult, you know?
Yeah. So I think there is definitely still muscle memory, you know, from before, and you don't feel extremely weird sitting in the driver's seat, because obviously it's something I've done for 7 years prior to the injury, right? So I'm very grateful that it happened after I've had like 7 years on the road, and that I don't have to be or learn this from scratch. I think it would have been maybe impossible. Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not planning to go that way. I mean, I'm fine like this, just walking and whenever possible going with Nick with the car, and that's fine. But
but you speak here, or I see in the show notes you wrote that you felt like you were reborn into someone else's life or someone else's body even. Like, can you maybe elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, I don't know. For me, I feel a lot of the times that I'm not me. And because it's been now 2 years, I think I'm talking that thing more from the beginning that I felt it. Now I feel like I'm slowly getting to know this new person. It's not the same. So I wouldn't say I know me again, because I don't think I'm that me. So I'm trying to get used to this new me, because it's so different. Like I want to say that I was ambitious, and maybe I still am, but I am going to put it in the past, because I think that ambition is not really comparable to the one now. Like I was ambitious more in the sense that I always wanted to be number one. I could not stand if I was like somewhere number two. I just had to be there at the top. And now that is unsustainable. Like I cannot sustain a mentality of I want to be always number one. It's just not healthy, and it's just not possible. So I'm trying to get used to how I am now.
Yeah,
it's difficult
to me. That word sustainable and sustainability, it kind of took a theme in my life. Yeah. I feel in so many different parts even. So I was talking the other day to a therapist of mine, and we were talking about the idea of some things are not sustainable today. So for instance, I won't be able to accept certain offers or certain challenges or certain okay, let me give a better example instead of talking like in the air. So say for example someone now wants me to learn how to, I don't know, do mountain climbing, for instance. Before, I might have been keen, I might not have been keen, but it's a challenge that I can accept and give a, pour some energy into it, or a new job or a new hobby or whatever it is, right? I could have poured energy into it. And sure, if it, didn't work out, then it didn't work out, but maybe I could have discovered something new that I loved and liked and, could have, integrated part of my life, but today I feel like I have to constantly again manage the idea of, is it going to be really sustainable? Like, is this going to be, am I going to be able to do this in the long run? And if the answer is no, then I kind of don't even want to start with it, because I feel like the amount of energy that I need to throw at something new, just getting to understand it, getting used to it, is going to be too much. And it might sound very pessimistic, but it is really not. It is more accepting. I feel like in the past, I could have seen it as a very pessimistic thing, but I don't see it as being pessimistic. I actually see it as, I know where my limitations are.
Yeah.
And sometimes I do feel like, okay, I can push myself a little bit further today, or I might work a couple of hours extra because, I'm in a good mood to throw extra hours into something that I know will take a lot of energy out of me. But I'm definitely not going to learn how to freaking unicycle or drive a motorcycle today, because I feel like it's going to take too much away from me and too much away from the other things
that you want to do.
That I know I love, or the things that I know bring me peace, that bring me rest, or whatever it is. So
that's right. I have that.
Or even like a couple of months ago, I was thinking, oh, maybe I should start a wine club, right? Because I've always loved wine. Being a student in Cape Town, where it's like the world of vineyards is like all around you, I really appreciated wine so much. And it might sound strange as a student, people are thinking that was just a good excuse to drink, but we really had an awesome, awesome wine club at the university, and I love it. And I still have a very much an appreciation for a good wine today. And I was thinking, toying around with this idea of, should I start a wine club in Pretoria? Because there is not really something that I know of, at least close by. And I really gave it like proper thoughts. And I think I was thinking, you know what? I don't think I should do this. And the reason to that is, I don't think if that is necessarily the most, the best way for me to spend like precious energy on, because I'm probably just going to waste it and it's going to leave me with having like less sleep, or at least less quality sleep.
Mm.
And I value my sleep too much that I am not willing to offer that up. Mm. I might join a club and like, you know, go every like once a month or something, but I don't want the responsibility on my own shoulders of hosting a wine club.
Exactly. I know what you mean. And I think,
you know, every second week or whatever it is.
I think a lot of us with brain injury can relate to that and have to make those choices at some point. Because when you said that you had to make the choice, it reminded me of the therapy that I had, because at the beginning I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that I will have to make choices between things. So they explained to me that, yes, you have now probably around 60% of the energy of a normal person. So if you think of it like a battery, you know, you're starting at 60%, the others are starting at 100. So your
That's
battery,
a very good way of explaining it.
Goes like much faster, and then you have to recharge. So you have to be careful what you spend your energy on, that it goes into only in those things that matter, and only in those things that like bring you peace and joy and, you know, accomplishment,
that
whatever.
Is so extremely well put.
Yeah, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, at least it did to me. And then I thought also I related it back to friendships, like which kind of friendships do I want to continue? Which kind of friendships do I want to put the little energy that I have into? Because I also had a lot of friendships that were mostly WhatsApp conversation things. And that also still takes a lot of energy, because, you know, people are still waiting on a reply or whatever. And then you have to read through everything that was said on the group, and it takes so much energy and time. So I was like, these things have to stop. I can't go through my energy so fast because of, you know, having to consume it on reading things back in a group or answering things.
That is very true. I remember this very distinctly. Injury was May, and by November of that same year, I attended the very first a get together of friends, like a party. It was someone's 30th birthday. And by that time, I already like experienced so many things, but also so little in a way.
Yeah.
You're kind of,
I get it.
Yes, like it's, yeah. And prior to the party, I've seen friends, like a couple, here and there, small groups, family, you know, again, like smaller groups of people, closer people. And I was so nervous going to the party, because I was thinking, oh my gosh, it's the first time I'm seeing so many people after my injury, and like, what are they going to say? What are they going to ask? It was also, I didn't even know or didn't even think of like, oh, how am I going to be in big crowds? Like, I didn't even think about that. The only experience that I had close to that was probably work things. Which was also, oh my gosh, I definitely did not say no enough. I definitely said yes too many times for work-related things, and I disappointed myself and I think so many others. But nevertheless, let's go back to the social life, first social event. And I was thinking, even Alexandra, it sounds probably so freaking weird, but I was even thinking of like, what should I wear? Should I dress as the injured one, or should I dress as myself? You know, the way I the way I see myself, because I almost didn't, it sounds strange, but I also wanted to kind of manage expectations, because one, I can like dress in, you know, a jean and a t-shirt for a 30th and look very much underdressed, but I might, people might, you know, expect less of me, and they might think like, you know what, let's just kind of back off a little on like questions and too many things. Or do I want to dress up the way I usually dress?
Yeah.
So I went for the high heels, the short skirt, which has loads of like florals on it, and bold different colors. So I went like, you know what, I'm not going to shy away from being myself. I'm going to like do whatever I would have, you know, done at a 30th birthday party.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's so strange to think about the party now, because I feel like I definitely gave the impression of like, oh, she's good, man. She's like, she's fine. Like, look at her. She's got her high heels on, her floral dress, you know, and people were definitely surprised to one, see me there, because I, maybe some of them thought I won't be there. And I felt like, yes, I definitely did dress up, and I'm usually the one that dresses up more than others. She must be fine now. And in a way, should I have been, not just then, but so many of my first encounters after the injury, should I actually have been a bit more quiet, a bit more reserved, a bit more less keen to say yes?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I even said yes for that business trip, you know, what was it, three months after the injury? May, so it was June, July, August. Yes, 3 months. And I really wanted to go. And I know I could have said no. I know I could have said like, I'm not going.
Yeah.
But in my head, I was like, you know what? I'm taking back my life.
So.
Yes, because at that point, just to give the listeners some idea, so we already moved back from Amsterdam to South Africa. I was living in South Africa. Alexandra was in Amsterdam, and we met up in the US for a big conference. And that was the first time we saw one another after our injuries as well. And it is an extremely, like, very, very busy, jam-packed conference. It's 4 days, and they really keep you busy and very much occupied. So we didn't even have so much time to catch up at that, you know, during the 4 days. And also, I feel like we... our headspaces
tried to catch up with
so
the company,
different to what it is today as well, right? Because I feel like we both, in a way, kind of yes, exactly. And but I'm not today. I feel like, you know, I was true to myself, and I wore my floral dress, and I didn't like hide away. But I really hope that, because I still feel misunderstood today. I still feel I get myself in strange situations. Like last week, someone asked me, so when are you going to start applying for positions again? You know, back at like, you know, again, like the same type of company or the same industry or something. And my answer was very clear. And I said, no, like this, what I'm doing now of like building my own sustainable brand, like that is where my full energy is going towards. This is what I'm doing. I'm definitely not going to apply to a position again. And by the way, I will never be able to work a full 8-hour day ever again.
Either.
That won't ever be possible for me again. And I feel like I might have hurt the individual by saying that, because it was a strong answer to maybe
I think
question of, hey, so how's it going? How's life? You know, kind of a question. And I definitely gave an answer with a punch, not like a punch being like a mean punch, but I mean like with an impact, right? Like a very definite, clear answer as to like, no, that will never ever be possible again. But I feel like I just want to set that expectation straight way to before people think coming like, back to Yes. And I kind of wanted to say like,
it's a problem, but I have difficulty right now in telling people what my limits are and making my point, kind of like I always want to be also true about, hey, I work this many hours and I don't think this is going to change. This is it. I can't do more. Even this that I'm doing now leaves me with no energy in the afternoon and in the evening. So I'm never doing anything for myself. But I have like still that problem where I'm like, I don't want to say it. It's so awkward. What are people going to think? I feel like... I don't know if embarrassed, but maybe like judged. That people are going to judge me based on that, like, oh, wow, working this many hours is like nothing, or I don't know.
But Alexandra, do you think it also could be that you and I love the fact that I knew you from before, that and the fact that I saw you at work and the way you work, but we both of us are such hard workers and we don't ever want to be seen as lazy. We never want to be seen as not doing our part. And to me, that like to be late or to be lazy or to be doing less than what is expected of me, to me, that is an awful feeling, and I never want to be in that situation. And I feel like the brain injury left me in that situation time and time and time and time and again at work. And I kind of, to me, it felt like I screamed at the top of my lungs for help and for assistance and for lowering of measures and accommodation and understanding. And I invited therapists into the office to try and make people understand. And I never experienced the lowering of standards that I also already had a uncomfortableness with myself. Like, I don't want to earn the same as the person next to me, but you know, expect to work less, right? It was also a difficult thing for myself even to ask for it. But to be denied of it was even more difficult, because now I am not doing my work the way I would have done it. I don't have the same, not just energy, but the same vigor and passion and everything that I can throw into my work. So it's, it just left me feeling, so not myself. Like, someone explained this to me as well. It was also in therapy, and I was really like at almost the breaking point of, it was almost a year into the injury. And I explained to the therapist, like, on the one hand, I am a young professional woman sitting in a meeting where I have to speak in a certain manner, present in a certain manner, be able to do all the high functions of a smart, cognitive, healthy individual of listening, writing, presenting, smiling, you know, whatever. And then, But 2 hours earlier, I was at rehab building blocks and having to play memory games of remembering 10 words in a row, and that complete disconnect of the two realities, the one where I cannot remember, I can maybe remember 2 out of the 10 words. But now 2 hours later, I am sitting in a meeting where a certain standard of presentation is expected of me.
That's exactly true.
I just couldn't. I got to a point where I couldn't handle that
disconnect
anymore, right?
And between what I actually can and when in rehab I saw that I can't even remember a few words after each other or the exercise with like a few numbers that were asked for me to repeat, and then indeed I had to go to work and pretend in a way, because it was like sort of pretending, because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't it was trying and thinking like,
yes,
oh, maybe today it's gonna be better, but
pretending.
It wasn't until the point that I said, hey, this is not gonna be better and we need to do something about it. And I think that helped that it stopped there. And it's such a hard topic, this, like, work after a brain injury, friends after a brain injury, family after a brain injury. It's just something that I think for all people with a brain injury are never going to be the same. I can personally, but maybe some, you know, say, hey, for me, it's the same. But I can't see anyone saying, hey, I had a brain injury and for me, everything is the same now. I can't see that. Like, I also am part of a group of young people with a brain injury here in the Netherlands. And unfortunately, I was shocked. The most of them are suffering a lot as a result of a concussion. So, yeah, they lost jobs. They couldn't finish their study. They couldn't drive anymore. A lot of things that they have lost, and people think just because of a concussion. But actually, there are like, I think 20 or 30% of concussions like don't go away and they kind of become, you know, sort of a brain injury. And they have that, but it's not a medical term. So here, here, it's not a medical term. So they can't be recognized as having a brain injury. So even those people I meant, yeah. So it's so difficult for them to come back and really try to find a job that accommodates them, because there's no medical term for a concussion that lasts. Like, there isn't...
I never thought about it that
way. In the beginning, that happens so often and so many young people. And then when it did happen here, and I mean, it happens everywhere, but when I saw it here in this group that I'm part of, I am trying to be much more understanding with people that say, hey, I have a concussion or had a concussion, because I'm like, wow, I think too many people probably discard them from the beginning, like concussion, you know, you just hit your head against the door or whatever, I don't know. So this is like a thing, like the whole brain injury that changes your life in every aspect. And I'm very curious to hear from the listeners what kind of struggles they had with the work, with the family, with the relationships. I think everyone has a different story, but maybe it's good in like closing to try and see, can we give any advice to them from our own experience?
Yeah, I think for myself, if I have to think of how I even want to be treated today, is that thing of, and we kind of touched on it, both of us, is that a few months into the injury, people are still very understanding, but also to understand that the patient themselves have to go through an entire grieving process and an entire realization of their new reality. And a lot of the time, strangely enough, like even after a year, I feel like my worst time after the injury was year one up to probably a year and a half, maybe a year and 7 months or something like that. That was my extremely very difficult, heavy, you know, depressive state. And you kind of have to realize as a friend or a family member of someone that 3 months after the injury is not the end of the injury, right? Is to, hey, how's it going? You know, in a really caring manner, because the thing of like walking past someone and saying, like, hey, how are you? Da, 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 da. It's not going to be a big enough chance to connect with someone, because a brain injured person goes through too many things to have a quick answer ready in their pocket to kind of yell at you on the go. You have to make time to listen to them if you want to still be their friend. And
for sure,
I would recommend a quiet place, something that is not too heavy and busy and so on. I would also recommend not doing it in front of a crowd of, you know, lots of people, and rather keeping it as a one-on-one conversation. Because you have to remember that if they are willing to share out of their lives, they will have to go through quite a lot of personal, you know, emotions when sharing with you. So you'll have to kind of create a space to accommodate for that. Not to ask them that deep, intense question every single day or every single week, but maybe check in with them. I don't know, Alexandra, I would say like every 3 months or something like that. Or, you know, if you really want to understand of what their current hurdle is, I think 3 months is maybe a good idea. Because for myself, I saw my injury and then the healing process that I still see as I still feel as though I'm in the healing process, but as like these big steps. I almost always imagined it as like a little ant climbing stairs, and you kind of think about an ant like looking up towards the sky, and you can see the rim of the little step. And I constantly thought like, oh, I just need to reach that rim.
Yeah.
And the rim could have represented like walking again, driving again, being able to work 8 hours again, you know, whatever it was, right? I thought like, I just saw that one rim. But then quickly when I reached the rim, I kind of also had that, you know, change of perspective from looking upwards, looking up at the sky. And from that position to looking into the next challenge, which is the next step, and then kind of approaching the next step and being at the bottom of the next step and climbing that next step, and then only seeing that one rim, that one goal, that one whatever it was. And I feel like my perspective definitely changed. Because many times I thought like just that one more thing. One more thing and I'll be fine again.
And it's consuming.
Yes, extremely tiring, right? And I think, after like, you know, probably five of that big expectations, realizing that there's constantly a new step, I kind of had to stand back and realize that it's an entire long staircase and not just a couple of steps to recovery. And I feel like at each of those, you know, steps, I needed support in a different way, because I was experiencing things very differently and my focus was set on different things. So if you want to check in with someone, know that their expectations will change for their recovery. They might not see the entire recovery as a journey, but more maybe as like small little things that they need to get done, and kind of just, you know, have sympathy with them and kind of support them wherever they need the support right now, right? So if they are at the point of talking to their HR manager of lessening the amount of hours, just be there for that, you know, just be there for that. And then, you know, in 3 months' time, when they're now at the house and they work, you know, the hours that they asked for, but they're now suffering from the social need and the fact that they actually miss seeing everyone. And they're going through a lot of internal conflict, because yes, they asked to work less hours and it's definitely better for them. Doesn't mean that they can't miss their friends and family.
It's a long process for understanding
even.
For others,
and then
too.
Just be there for that.
That's true. I think my one advice that I really would like to give is for the person that has a brain injury themselves is to take it slow, because I think you and I both kind of rushed through just trying to get back to our life. And in my eyes, I see that as my biggest mistake, because I didn't want to take my time. I didn't want to, I didn't think it's needed to that much to really go through a recovery place. I thought that rehabilitation, yes. I thought that everything is going to be just as before.
Do you mean rehabilitation?
And with that, I think I screwed it up for myself in a way. Well, not that it would be much different now if I did it differently, but in the sense that it gave me more trouble, more stress, more pushing myself too much and too fast. And it just hurt me instead of, you know, just being slow and expecting that things take time. And the same thing with friendships. I should have maybe expected that some people are not ready to take the long road with you. Like, some people are not ready to be a friend forever that understands that the other person is not the same anymore. The other person has different needs now. I should have maybe, but of course I didn't have where to take the example from. But if I were now in the situation, I would think from the beginning, hey, there will be some people that are going to not be my friends anymore. There are some people from the family that are probably going to be more distant from now on. And some advice like that, just for people to not have too big expectations from the others.
Yeah, and I would also say, like, a thing would be is that if you are going through it, it is...
Oh, yes.
You will have a ton of emotions. I don't even want to say a lot. It's going to be a ton of emotions. It's going to feel like a roller coaster. Like, so many days, Alexandra and I have talked and we've said that, oh, I'm having a high or I'm having a low, or we would tell each other that while I was on the high, this happened and it like slam bammed, you know, broke me down and I, you know, caused this big low.
Oh, yes.
And it's very important to get therapy, I'd say. For me, that was a very, 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 very crucial part of my healing process. So my neurologist actually put me in contact with a therapist, and I'm very happy that he had the insight into doing that, of thinking this person or this individual, and I hope that he does that with all of his patients. I don't know. I suppose he does. We'll need someone, but then I didn't really gel or get along that. I didn't connect with the person that he gave me the number of. And I'm very, very grateful that there was a person in my family that looked out for me. And she checked in with me once and I mentioned that I'm struggling. And she asked me about therapy and I said, like, I didn't really connect with the person that my neurologist gave me. And I felt like it was a waste of time and money. So I stopped the sessions. And she really, what's the word? She really said, like, Beata, you need this. And she kind of made my first appointment for me. She kind of forced me into it. And I'm happy that she had the insights into the
fact that I needed. Asking for help is very important.
Loads more help.
Well, a tough topic, but yes. You know, we I think we caught on the tips of it, because it's such a, you know, such a deep and long topic that you can talk about in like the whole day for the whole week. We'll definitely come back to it. So we just want to thank everyone for listening today, and we hope that you enjoyed the conversation we had, and we are waiting to hear from you with questions and with your own experience.
Yes, and if you know of anyone that will appreciate this podcast, please send it to them. I'm sure they will appreciate it too. Thank you so much, everyone, and have a good day. Bye.